Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to today's History Hack, which I'm excited about because Alina's basically got me a present.
I did get you a present, and I hope you like your present.
I'm very excited to open it. Sounds weird because it's a person. I'm excited to talk to this person.
Right, well, I'm going to tell you who this person is. It's Constantin Gladgar, who is a historian and academic who specialises in the visual culture in relation to settler colonialism and refugee rights. And her PhD thesis was Atlas of Denial, which won the 2023 Dean's Award for Outstanding PhD Thesis. And she's here to talk about Australian colonialism. Happy-go-lucky, Alex. There you go.
I'm so excited because obviously Australia becomes a dominion in 1901. And that's when they get to stand on their own two feet. And my God, we'll get to some fuckery later, but I suspect we're going to start even further back to set it in context. Constanza, hello.
Hi. Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
And this is Atlas of Denial. I love the title. I love it because we're going to talk so much about kind of the way maybe Australia has historically wanted you to look at how it's made up and why, and actually what was going on in the background, and what was like, oh my God, the theory behind some of it just makes me so angry. But let's talk about, first of all, and I'm guessing this is why you chose to, I mean, you're Italian, but I'm guessing this is why you chose to focus on Australia.
Yeah, so I'm originally Italian, and I've been in the UK for like the past 13 years on and off. My background is actually in art history, which is why I'm more of a cultural historian, and I'm kind of across like cultural studies and visual culture.
You're another one of these people like me and Alina that falls asleep if there's too much political crap, basically.
I do love to stare at pictures.
Yeah. and talk about people as well, as opposed to policy.
Yeah, I like to think of it as as a historian, I'm really interested in the why rather than the what or the when. So I try to look at, I do contemporary history, and I try to look at how we got here and why. And because of my cultural studies training, I tend to be a bit of a Freudian and have like a psychoanalytic approach to structures of oppression and even major political events like war. I tend to look at the kind of affective registers and emotional drives really that underpin them. Because I think a lot of the time we tend to read violent events through the lens of, it's a cold and calculating thing. And when we do read them critically, we think of it as, you know, the ruling classes are sending the working classes to war to make money.
It's all top down, isn't it?
Yes. And it's not, I mean, you know, there's an element of that, but I think it's a lot more complex than that, because if it really was all rational, I think things would look very differently. Maybe better, maybe worse, but very different nonetheless.
I think like So the book I'm doing at the moment is very much bottom up, like people's mm-hmm. history. And I've literally just finished a chapter on a massive battle in World War One where I gave the casualty figures. But then the final paragraphs are actually about a couple of guys who were wounded, not killed in action. So they're not part of that number, but literally are lying in a hospital with bits of their brain hanging out. And they both end up dying of infections and stuff, because like that is what matters to me more than I yes. think like just saying this division went there and that. So I think we're going to be friends. So I guess what makes Australia unique then as a settler colony, going back to the beginning?
So just a super brief distinction. So there are two types of colonialism, very broadly. There is external or extractive colonialism, which is often what Britain has done, which is essentially going to a different country and...
It's like Windrush, isn't it? Please come and live here. We have jobs. We need people.
But also specifically, basically what preceded Windrush, which was going to a country and extracting natural resources. So it would be like sugar, tea, minerals, and of course, free labor by enslaving the local population. But it's very much... It's kind of like it's an opportunist drive. It's going to a country and it is establishing just enough of a base there to be able to exert power over the local population. Settler colonialism is quite different, because settler colonialism is when the colonizers come to stay. And so it's not just about establishing like a military position, but it's about starting an entirely new nation on indigenous land, in the case of Australia. And the logic of settler colonialism is therefore quite different, because there is an intent. Patrick Wolf, who's kind of the father of settler colonialism as a discipline, calls it the logic of elimination and replacement, because it's not just about taking what you can get out of the local people. It's about essentially eliminating the local people and replacing them with not just settlers, but also settler culture, settler history, settler understanding of what happened. And that makes for a very interesting case study for the kind of history that I want to do, because I want to think about, you know, like, again, like the less rational drives that were going on. And I went to Australia in 2014 to do a study abroad during like my undergrad, and I was really fascinated by the kind of like the gaping chasm between the...
It's there, isn't it? It's because it's the justification that you've had to give to yourself as a nation for why you did what you did to the original population.
Yes. And when I went there, it was really... I was very surprised by what I found, because Brand Australia worldwide is, first of all, we don't think of it as a settler colony at all. We just think of it as a Western nation, really. We don't think of it as an occupation. We don't think of it as like a very recent occupation and kind of like ongoing, you know, tension between indigenous sovereignty and like the settler colonial state. We don't think of any of these. Like, Australia really only makes international news when like a kangaroo gets lost in a supermarket.
Or the emu war, something novelty like that, or cricket. Yeah.
Something to do with flora and fauna. And what I actually found when I went there was a nation that is deeply anxious and kind of like deeply committed to denying its own history, and that has an incredibly militarized border and one of the most draconian policies against refugees, like to this day, and that, you know, practices indefinite detention for asylum seekers. There are people who have been essentially imprisoned for up to 7 years with you know, in offshore facilities that have, you know, no obligation to abide by human rights law. And I didn't know about any of that. And I went there as like a bright eyed and bushy tailed 23-year-old. And I was like, yay, I'm going to do so much surfing. you know, like, and I became really obsessed with it. And I became really obsessed with this. I think as an Italian, we have an interesting relationship with, historical memory, because obviously we were part of like the baddies in World War II, but we don't have the same level of commitment as Germany towards like remembrance and taking accountability. It's kind of, it's a bit in between. Like we talk about the World War II so much, like extensively, but we never quite talk about it in terms of something that we did. We more talk about it in terms of something that happened to us.
Yeah.
And you know, and so I developed an interest in that and in kind of hermeneutic like research since I was young, and then going to Australia and finding a country that wasn't even in that limbo that I was so familiar with, but was flat out like, you know, nothing happened here. I don't know what you're talking about. It was just so interesting to me that I wanted to look into it further.
I guess it starts, doesn't it, with the fact that it is so unique in that it is a settler colony, but settling people Britain didn't want anymore. So it's not like it's not like New Zealand is very different. New Zealand is a come to this amazing country and start a new life.
Yeah.
This was very much we're just going to dump the people we don't want anymore down here, which I guess is going to give you issues from the start, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, so once I started my PhD and started sort of like really looking into it, I realized that Australia is a really unique settler colony compared to other kind of Western settler colonies like North America, Canada, New Zealand. And one of the primary ways in which it's different is that it was a large scale military operation. So in the United States, we have this myth of, well, I mean, it's a true story, but we have this kind of legendary aura of the pioneers. And the pioneers were still like an invading force in comparison to indigenous people, but they were kind of doing it on their own. Whereas what happened in Australia was that in 1770, James Cook was tasked by two sponsors, the Royal Society, the Royal Geographical Society, and the Crown, to set sail for this kind of unknown land that they wanted to learn more about. And the task by the Royal Geographical Society was to map the transit of Venus across the sun. So it was an astronomical mission. But the task from the Crown instead was to essentially scout out whether this great landmass could be useful to England in any way. Whether it could be a convenient place where to not only, you know, grow the British Empire, but also, as you said, like kind of displace a bunch of undesirable people that they really wanted to get rid of because the prisons were all full, largely because they were putting people in prisons for all kinds of things. So
that's not, they do that with America as well, don't they? Like they're sending to the American colonies like prisoners. It's like you can go to jail or you can go to America, and people are given the option. So it's not the same, is it?
It's not the same because it wasn't basically for Australia. It essentially started as a prison island, in the sense that prisoners were deported often against their will. Which I think is also a really interesting tension because, you know, I'm a decolonial scholar. So a lot of my practice is about critiquing colonialism and kind of, you know, ideally eventually maybe having a minor impact on dismantling it. But I try to always maintain nuance because, you know, most of the people who end up doing the colonizing in Australia didn't want to be there at all. And I think that's, you know, that's something that we need to acknowledge. And I think that's, you know, that's true of a lot of historical large-scale events.
So I guess before we get into how the descendants of those people then start to view themselves mm-hmm. as settlers and that, we need to talk about terra nullius, don't we? So what is that as a concept and how does that come about?
So the second way in which Australia is a majorly unique settler colony is that no formal treaty was ever reached with indigenous population. Like, indigenous sovereignty was never ceded.
Can I just quickly, before we answer that, what was the population when we started sending people there? Because I have no sort of scale of concept. I know Australia is massive, but I don't know how many Aboriginal peoples were there.
So we don't have exact numbers, but we do know that over 200 nations existed in the continent that we now think of as like one unified nation. And the reason why we don't have exact numbers, I think there are two kind of answers to this question. One answer would be, you know, Indigenous people did not have written histories. They only had oral histories. And so, unfortunately, we could not, we cannot retrieve this data. But I think, you know, a decolonial answer would be there was no interest on behalf of the settler.
It makes the whole, so terra nullius means nobody's land. It means it doesn't belong to anyone. It implies that it was completely empty when we got there, and it's bullshit.
There was no intention and there was no incentive for the colonizers to record numbers of indigenous people, because the intention was very much to deny there was anyone there. And I think what's interesting about this is that, so James Cook arrives in Australia in 1770, and he has his traveling journals and everything, and he does record the presence of indigenous population. He even records the presence of indigenous farming and agriculture, and this will be relevant in a moment. but upon his return to the motherland, essentially, he reports his findings, and amongst his findings, he reports that there is an indigenous population, but they would probably be quite easily overpowered by the British Navy and like a British military operation. So decisions are made. And then in 1788, the first fleet arrives to establish the penal colony on the eastern side of the continent. And it really was a large scale military operation. And terra nullius as a concept was kind of deployed retroactively around 1820.
Uh-huh.
And it essentially it involved a practice of forging documents and saying that yes, there are indigenous people here, but it was only about 20 of them, and yes, they're doing something with the land, but it's not really agriculture. And the reason why this was important, whether it was agriculture or not, is because private property by British common law was dependent on the presence of agriculture. You need to work the land in order to own the land. And if you don't work the land, you do not have a right to own the land.
So as a layman, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, like, well, why treat Australia like this when you didn't do this to, like, indigenous Indians? I mean, we did all kinds of different things to different people, then none of them were good. But it's funny, isn't it? You go to India and you can utilize those indigenous people to pick tea for you and make silk and generate like revenue.
That was extractive colonialism. So there was no need to undermine, basically during extractive colonialism, there's an understanding that you have defeated a local population and then you are taking their stuff.
As far as we're concerned with Australia, it looks like we don't consider that there's any stuff to take. So we'll just have it and make out there was no one here.
Yeah. And again, this is because of this logic of elimination and replacement, because you have to eliminate what's there in order to replace it.
So this is the argument about no agriculture. You're saying there's nothing there.
Yeah. So essentially, English common law was based on the right. I don't want to get too technical, but it was based on John Locke's philosophy and somebody called Emmerich de Vattel, who was a Swiss philosopher. And both of them, everything, they were saying about this boils down to, if you do not work the land, you do not deserve the land, because there are, we live in a finite world with limited resources and limited land. And therefore, the land should go to whoever is going to make the most of it. And that is, I mean, just sociopathic because, you know, I mean, even if we don't go into kind of like looking at like, you know, global warming today and kind of like aggressive extraction. And even if we don't go into questioning, like, you know, is that actually the best use of the land? It's also the idea that like, imagine I come into your house and then I'm like, well, it's a bit dusty, which I personally have designed a law to say that if your house is dusty, then it should be mine instead of yours. So it's mine now because I have the guns. So I make the laws and my laws say that me taking your house is perfectly legal.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so terra nullius is bullshit, but there it is. It's employed retroactively in the 1820s. So 50 years after Cook's been there. To justify, but then that myth just keeps getting perpetuated, doesn't it? And it's just, is it just because the Aboriginal people, the Indigenous people didn't have a voice, like a worldwide voice, like their
did? So, I mean, it's, you know, did they not have a voice or did we silence and strangle that voice, like very much? Because there were, so essentially, the colonial archive very much serves the colonial interest. So if we go by, like something that I deal in a lot is like, how do we uncover hidden histories? Because so long as we go by a colonial, essentially, standard of proof, we're not going to find any proof that colonialism is bad. Like, it's as simple as that. And so it's hard to say at times, if we go by kind of like what counts as official data, especially in academia, it's sometimes hard to say exactly what happened in the first 50 years of colonialism. But if we listen to literally any Indigenous people, they will tell you that what happened was large-scale genocide. And once that kind of like more explicit genocide, once it, literally killing people kind of started being a little bit frowned upon by the global community, then the colony changed tactic and resorted to different kinds of genocide. So we think, for example, of the Stolen Generations, which was, so the practice of removing Indigenous children from their community and displacing them all the way across the country, therefore severing their relationship to their own land. And their own cultural practices and kind of destroying the transmission of language and culture. And because really, I mean, if we go by the human rights definition of genocide, it's not just the killing of people, but it's the killing of culture. And the Stolen Generations absolutely does fit the profile of genocide. It was just a less shooty kind of genocide.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, and it's similar, isn't it, to what's happening with the Native Americans at the same time, where they're taking their children and sending them to Western schools and just basically indoctrinating them with Western philosophy so that they don't grow up perpetuating their own culture.
And the idea of this is also to, once again, silence Indigenous people, because by severing their relationship to their family and their people and their cultures and their traditions, I mean, you really are destroying oral histories.
In a real sadistic way as well, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, it's the...
I mean, when you go for the kids, I feel like you've upped it another level.
Yes, I definitely think so. And I mean, Australia has since officially apologized for the Stolen Generations in 2008, but it hasn't stopped doing it. Like,
well, I just will get to it, but I'm just stunned at what's still going on in the 60s. Like, I didn't know. Like, I asked some Australian academics for some reading material because my mind was just blown. But let's talk about. So the first people that are sent there don't necessarily want to be there. They're not all transported. Some people do voluntarily go to Australia. But then you've got a new generation of people being born in Australia, but still considering themselves kind of British as well as Australian. And there's this whole sort of dynamic between still being connected to the motherland and all of that crap. But how do they see themselves as settlers and colonials then, up against this myth that it was empty, so it was theirs rightfully anyway?
So much of my PhD was about this, and about like what's, you know, we understand the history, but what's going on now?
Because,
we're talking about three generations here. Like we're really talking about people's grandparents or great grandparents, and how are they reconciling with this history and with this past? And
quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The simplest answer that I can give is, you know, my thesis is titled Atlas of Denial. So largely they don't think of themselves as settlers. They don't think of themselves as occupying indigenous land in any way. They don't, it's not something that's commonly recognized. And, a lot of my thesis was looking at visual culture as a kind of, atlas. To look at how they think of themselves, because I'm like, how do they represent Australia? How do they represent Australians? And how do they represent Indigenous people? Because that's, you know, it wasn't a social science project, so I couldn't really go interview people. So I was like, okay, let's look at what stories they tell, essentially. And one of the biggest things that you can really see with like a 5-minute Google is that most Tories campaigns that Australia puts out are based on emptiness. They're based on, look at this amazing expanse of glorious land that is yours for the taking because it was ours for the taking. And you as a tourist can come and enjoy this paradise and this kind of amusement park with the koalas and, you know, watch out for the spiders. But then there's the colorful parakeet. And it's like there was this ad that was quite controversial. That essentially it was a video campaign and it featured all the marvels that Australia had to offer. And it had, you know, like the beautiful dolphins and, you know, everything else. And at some point it has a group of Aboriginal dancers who were hired to perform and announce, you know, we have been rehearsing for 40,000 years. I think, you know, because rehearsal is like, it's a particularly cruel term because it's the idea that, you know, like really that Indigenous people existed as entertainment and continue to exist as entertainment.
Yeah,
and
they're not dancing bears, people.
Yeah, they're there to, you know, to serve the colony, essentially, the colony and its guests that it gets to invite because it has sovereignty.
So... I feel like I'm using things because we're talking about a really inflammatory thing, and we could be talking about any colonizing nation, but we're talking to an expert on Australia. So it's not like we're just sitting here intentionally trashing Australia and avoiding the uncomfortable with everybody else. But I feel like because they are so far away, I'm talking very much about like the turn of the 20th century, because that's my wheelhouse. And I've just been looking at things like why Aborigines weren't allowed to serve in the First World War in 1914. And I feel like they're so far away that there's almost this manic way of proving they're still one of Britain. They're still white. They're still British. They're still Western. They're not ethnic, because And some of the ways that gets represented, like you say, it's there in visual culture. When you see recruitment campaigns during the war and whenever you like tourism stuff, even then you don't see people enticing you to come and spend time with Aborigines. Everybody's white in the adverts. And one of the things they had in from 1901, I think it was, but you'll know, when they became a dominion and were self-governing, at least not foreign policy, obviously, but self-governing within, mm-hmm. so therefore in charge of their own cultural identity, is that Australia is so obsessed with its whiteness that it has a policy about immigrants. So this is a settler nation that needs settlers because it was apparently empty before. Just the contradictions just blow my mind. Exactly. And yet there is a ban on Asian people. There's an obsession with yellow peril. There's a whole another thing, but that they have a whiteness clause to maintain the whiteness of Australia in the 20th century.
Yes. I just want to say one thing. Sorry. We're not supposed to use the term Aborigines anymore.
I know. I keep trying going between Aborigine and Indigenous because I'm not sure that every Indigenous person in Australia was Aboriginal. So yeah.
So we can use Indigenous or we can use Aboriginal people, but just not Aborigines.
Okay, cool.
Maybe we can just like go back and edit it out or something. But I didn't want to like let you set yourself up, basically.
No, it's cool. I mean, I probably wouldn't even edit it out. Let's leave it in because it's interesting to learn. Because actually, I'm sitting there and I'm typing this up in my own manuscript. And I'm like, I don't know. Is it Aboriginals with an L? Is it Aborigine? Like, I don't know because no one's ever told me. So yeah, it's cool.
Because that's the thing. It's not talked about. It's supposed to be Aboriginal people. So that is
okay.
Yes.
Because it feels like you said, like 200 nations. It's been uncomfortable using the word, and it's why I keep going back and replacing it with Indigenous, because it's like you're lumping everybody as one, and they're not one.
Absolutely. Exactly. I mean, that's also the thing. Like it's. I mean, I could talk about this for an hour, but. So let's talk about the border, because I think that's actually a good way to bring together everything.
Yeah, we'll leave that in because now everybody's learned from the fact that I didn't know. But let's talk about this whiteness clause and defending the border from encroachment on how they look at themselves.
Yeah. So the White Australia policy was essentially in force for most of the 20th century until the 70s. And it's exactly as you said, it's about populating the colony because it's, you know, it doesn't have enough settlers. And if it doesn't have enough settlers, it might get overpowered by Indigenous people. So there's this sense of urgency about populating the colony, but the colony has to be white. It has to preserve its whiteness. Hence the White Australia policy. And the very specific tension that exists. So all settler colonies, because again, as you say, you know, we can talk about like, you know, there's common traits to all settler colonies. So all settler colonies have one specific thing in common, which is they operate under the logic of preemptive violence and self-defense. And they tend to have incredibly militarized borders and incredibly strong anxieties surrounding the possibility of being invaded and or corrupted by people, well, essentially immigrants, like infiltrating the colony and undermining its way of life.
They're constantly talking about like opening the floodgates, aren't they? If yes, we let in one, we've got to let them all in. Like that's the philosophy.
And that's the thing. I mean, that's, you know, xenophobia and racism exist, you know, but most anywhere really. So those themes are not unique, but they are incredibly heightened within settler colonies. And as a cultural historian, I think that the reason for that is basically a projective anxiety. Because, I mean, psychoanalytically speaking, denial has a price, and that price is neurosis and anxiety. So typically, wherever there is denial, especially massively and on a historical level, on a cultural level, you get national anxiety. And that national anxiety within white settler colonies tend to express itself as a massive fear of invasion and annihilation specifically. And it's something that is extremely, extremely aggressively present in Australia. Again, we think of the treatment of refugees, we think of the White Australia policy, but we can also think of the ways in which the Gothic is one of the most common kind of genres. Like, the Australian Gothic is really prevalent, and the Australian Gothic is all about people disappearing in the land, and specifically settlers disappearing in the land. Now, when we look at the United States, we can think of Westerns, and that's an entire genre about settlers and pioneers defeating Native Americans. So there is this triumphalist narrative that does acknowledge that a battle was fought, but takes pride in having won it. In Australia, there is hardly ever Indigenous people in movies. Like, they just, you know, they don't exist. Terra nullius, there was nobody here, so we can't even have them demonized as villains. They just have to not be in the picture. But what is there is a constant theme of people mysteriously vanishing and disappear and bringing about the end of the colony. So Picnic at Hanging Rock is such an interesting case, because it's one of the most successful Australian movies of all times, and it's really the story of the disappearance of these four settler girls.
Yeah, they're from a boarding school, aren't they? And they go out for a picnic at Hanging Rock, and then nobody ever sees them again, is the premise of the film.
Exactly. So it's these four girls at a settler boarding school in kind of like early days colonization. And
if you look at the outfits, think the Railway Children. They all look like Jenny Agutta and the Railway Children, the long hair and the bows and all that crap. So,
and they disappear, and their disappearance is never explained. But also, their disappearance happens halfway through the movie. Like, the climax of the movie is not actually their disappearance. The second half of the movie is about what their disappearance does to the local community. And, you know, children are the future of the nation, but girls are the reproductive future of the nation. So they are both the future and the ways in which the future is reproduced. And so it's a double damage. And so essentially the community falls apart. Like, you know, the headmistress dies, like people, you know, kill themselves. Like, it's just complete ruin is brought about.
Which is so ironic when you think about all of the Aboriginal people's children being taken away from them.
Exactly. So something that is so fascinating to me is the ways in which Australians actually talk about these things all the time. It's just that they cut Indigenous people out of the narrative. So they're like, oh no, children disappearing. That's terrible, you know? And I'm like, yes, it is terrible. Can we talk about the stolen generations? No.
It's an incredible, and I think, like you've been saying all along, a unique compartmentalization, isn't it?
It is. And I think we have a phrase in Italian, which is la lingua batte dove il dente duole, which is your tongue will always find the tooth that hurts. In the sense of you will return to the pain point. And that's very much what seems to be happening with this, because it's like, we cannot talk about the genocide, we cannot talk about colonialism, but somehow we always end up talking about people disappearing and colonization, like cultures and societies dying out. So, you know, it's this weird national obsession with emptiness that then circles all the way back around to a fear of emptiness.
It's mental. I just talk about this all day. But what you end up with, I think, even now, which is obviously part of your research, is contemporary as well, is this huge tension in Australia. I mean, like, we're probably going to have people have a go at us for this episode, and I'm frankly not interested because we're just investigating like stuff, we're not taking a side. But there's a huge tension, isn't there, between remembering, which is something, so we have way back, like episode 25 is Matt McLaughlin talking about the myth of the Anzacs, like the culture around the Anzacs and the mythology besides it. So an intense commitment to remembering parts of the past, and an intense commitment to forgetting or glossing over. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. I genuinely think that that is the ultimate description. Like, that's truly at the heart of Australian culture today, because there is this tension between, remembering and forgetting that ultimately produces anxiety and then aggressive responses to that anxiety. Like, it's a very reactive culture. So I think, for example, of their response during the pandemic, which was one of the most extreme ones, I want to say, because they completely...
Western Australia, most certainly. I mean, he just locked the doors, the guy in charge there, didn't he?
I mean, so, you know, personal, let's do some autoethnography here. So I moved to Australia for my PhD, and then I happened to be outside of the country in March 2020. And I had, at the time, I had a student visa that was valid until 2023. And overnight, my visa became void. All visas were essentially completely worthless because they locked the border to anyone who did not have a passport, which also means they locked the border to residents. Like, they locked the borders to people who were living there, working there, had families there, had children there. And if they were foreign, or if they were foreign nationals, they were not considered part of Australian society, and therefore they could not go back to Australia. They had to, you know, go back to wherever they were from. This was basically the narrative.
Which they may not have been in that place for decades.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the exception was people who had permanent residence, which is a particular kind. I think it's similar.
Yeah. We in the UK, you have leave to remain, and then you have indefinite leave to remain. And
But yeah, so most countries, you know, they might have temporarily for a couple of months at a time, most Western countries might have closed to tourism, but none of them closed to residents or students or anybody else who was, you know, rooted in.
Yeah, Alina was repatriated within what, 2 weeks to Poland?
There you go.
Or from Poland?
Yes, sorry, couldn't hit the button fast enough. Yes, I was repatriated. They did repatriation within days, but trying to get on a repatriation plane was the hardest thing. That was probably the most difficult thing to
but
do.
You weren't just like, as you weren't just locked out.
No, God, no. Poland was like, we will start. They basically started sending planes to every remote corner of the world, even if you, there were no planes going there. So, for example, Polish lot doesn't fly to, what's that little airport in London?
London City Airport.
Yeah, it doesn't fly to City Airport, but they sent planes to City Airport to collect their citizens anyway. And that was crazy.
No, I mean, there were people, I remember there was a family of Australians who had to live in a hostel for like 10 months because they had nowhere to go. And I mean, I lost all of my belongings. Like, it was deeply unpleasant, the whole thing. But it was also, I mean, you know, as a historian, it was kind of oddly fascinating because I was like, oh, okay. So that tells me a lot about the logic of, you know, it's the idea of like, we have to protect our own, but who is and isn't our own is not like, you know, it's not immediately clear.
And it's also not a democratic process establishing that, is it? I mean, I understand in a pandemic it was ruthless and it was quick, but there was no democratic process by which they decided.
It was a very reactive decision because it was very extreme. But it then lasted 18 months. Like, there was no kind of like cooling off period and then, oh, okay, fine, we'll reopen for residents now. No. Like, they stayed closed the whole time. And I think that was really interesting because, again, it's this idea of like this fear of something coming, be it like a tsunami wave, you know, the last wave is like a bit, it's a big myth within Australian culture, this idea that like the last wave of this is going to come and destroy Australia. Or, you know, the waves of the masses of immigrants that they think are coming. And like, when I think of like very, very, very few vessels actually try to approach Australia to carry asylum seekers, like it's double digits, but the response is so extreme that you would think that there are 1,000 boats coming every single morning. And there are so many occasions in which frankly, the cruelty has been completely disproportionate. Like, I think, for example, of the deterritorialization of Melville Island. So essentially in, I think 2003, yes, 2003, 14 asylum seekers managed to arrive in on a ship to Melville Island in November 2003. And as per the kind of legal system, refugees who arrive on Australian soil have the right to request asylum. You need to be on Australian soil to request asylum. And, you know, all that was at stake was the Australian population growing by 14 people. But that was apparently such a threatening prospect that what the Australian government actually did was deterritorialize Melville Island and 4,000 other islands for good measure, and to do so retroactively to the night before, so that essentially the asylum seekers were no longer on Australian soil.
That's brutal, isn't it? And yeah. It's also I used to work in immigration, and it's an entanglement that I don't think you'll ever rectify the human element from the need to police it somehow. But yeah, that is, I don't think I've heard of anything quite so legally stringent. Like, obviously there's all kinds of fuckery going on in Europe, yeah. But in terms of a government laying down a rule, yeah, that is that brutal.
And also so quick, because again, yeah, like, you know, it's very, very difficult to get a visa for Australia. Mm. And then you get it and overnight it no longer exists. And it's very, very difficult to arrive to Australia by boat. And then you arrive and, sorry, just kidding, this is not Australia anymore. You never arrive to Australia because we have decided that as of yesterday, this is no longer Australia. So it's very reactive. It's a very quick machine, I think, compared to what we have in Europe, which is like, you know, slower, like significantly slower. But it's also kind of, you know, it's expedient, but it's expedient in a very brutal way. And it's once again, we can go back to the beginning in terra nullius. It's this idea of like, you know, we make the laws and we can change them anytime. We can take them back anytime, and we can make laws that mean that whatever we need to go goes. And it's, and again, there is this kind of reactive anxiety of like, no, we cannot allow, you know, 14 refugees to illegally arrive, because if 14 arrive, then thousands will arrive. And, you know, that's not really the case, and it's not really how it works. And, but it's, yeah, it's this kind of projective anxiety.
That's mental. And just like, we've focused on Australia today, but just an example of how colonialism is still fucking up the planet. So just to wrap up then, I think it's a really complicated legacy that Australia, mm-hmm, and the Indigenous people of Australia in particular are having to live with. And it really does blow my mind. Like you said, that this whole white Australia thing perpetuating in like living memory, well into living memory. What kind of efforts are being made to repair the stuff that's been done?
So I think something that happened very recently that was a pretty significant attempt at repairing was the Australian Indigenous Voice referendum from October 2023. And essentially a referendum was held to discuss the possibility of offering Indigenous people a permanent voice within Parliament.
So this is specifically then, are we saying there is no Indigenous representation, or does it come and go and this is like basically establishing a quota?
There is no
saying there always has to be one now.
Yeah, it's establishing a quote. Well, it's establishing specifically an Indigenous voice. So currently there are Indigenous MPs in Parliament, yeah, but they are not there as, in order to represent Indigenous people. They are just there to represent their specific district, and they happen to be Indigenous.
Okay.
Whereas the suggestion was to put in somebody who would be who would be there to represent Indigenous interest, essentially. And it was voted down by a landslide majority in every single state.
That's incredible. So what Australia overwhelmingly said, or what, sorry, what the Australian Parliament overwhelmingly said is we don't feel the need in 2023 to promise the Indigenous population that there will always be someone with a voice for them in government.
Yes, so it wasn't voted within Parliament. It was a public referendum.
Oh, okay. So it was the Australian people saying that then.
Which I think is especially cutting.
Yeah, because I feel like there's a certain amount of politicians are always self-interested, aren't they, in their own position, and it might affect them. But if it was the entire population saying, yeah, we don't need that.
Yes. I mean, it was 17 million people. Voting. So it was really, you know, all voters essentially. Because in Australia, they have a very active democracy because you get fined if you don't vote. So their results tend to be, you know, very, there's no question on whether they actually represent the will of the majority. So this really, really was the majority. And they all voted no. And I, you know, personally, with my kind of professional focus, to me, this really spells out the perseverance of denial, because, you know, it's the idea of like, if we give Indigenous people a voice, then we have to confront why they deserve one. And we have to confront the fact that we are on their land and that we have historically silenced them and that they are an oppressed minority. And I was really convinced it would win. I was really, really convinced that this would happen. Because I had seen signs that Australia was beginning to be ready to reckon with its past. And I think it was a devastating loss, because it really said, you know, no, they're not. Like,
Constanza, this is, even though I've not had been able to get a word in edgewise because Alex got too excited and I let her run riot. So
on an episode where genocide was mentioned as well.
Yes, well, yes, but you got excited, and I wanted you to enjoy yourself on a podcast. I haven't given you a present like this in a while, so I thought you deserved a bit of solo time here. So I've done the beginning and the end, which is fantastic. I've sat here having a listen the whole time. I learned a lot of new stuff, even from Alex. Didn't even know you knew half this kind of stuff. Kind of shocked me there a little bit.
I probably didn't about 2 months ago before this bloody book, but yeah.
Well, there you go. Constanza, it's been great having you on. I'm so glad I managed to force you to come on and do this. Apologies for that. When is your first book going to come out about this?
So I'm working on publishing my thesis as a monograph. And I have an article coming out on History Workshop on basically Australia's treatment of refugees in February. And another one coming out in Textures, which is a French academic journal, which will come out at the end of the year on ecocide within settler colonial nations. So hopefully soon.
And while you're waiting for that, just go watch Rabbit Proof Fence with Kenneth Branagh.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just watch that film and be wowed.
Anyways, it's been great having you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.